Alan wants to say something.
As usual, I just wanted to draw attention to the fact that the cost of living rises are a global event. Moggy will tell you the same about New Zealand, that prices are sky high. Where I live, the prices are sky high. And really, it's not a British problem, although there might be certain elements of it, but because of government policy. But America's screaming about the price of gas there. So really, is it all down to a supply chain problem with the Russian-Ukrainian invasion? Because we're going to, the United Nations are saying that there's going to be a food crisis inevitable. And as we know, when the price of food goes up, people take to the streets, especially people who are already desperate and in a precarious standard of living. We saw that, I think, with the Arab Spring, which was caused by food prices. So globally, should we be looking at it as a world event, or maintain that it's just a run-of-the-mill British problem that the Bank of England has any influence over? Basically, that's what I'm saying, that again, we have to think globally rather than parochially.
No, you're quite right. It is a, I mean, there is a global crisis which is going to get, going to get worse. I mean, we've already seen governments being toppled in Ceylon, and the last time something like this happened after the crash, a crash of 2008. You saw the result was the Arab Spring, which also toppled governments over. So I'd expect, with the price of wheat, going up, and that is a direct result of the Ukraine war and the sanctions that are imposed on Russia, since Russia and Ukraine are the breadbasket of at least the Middle East and certainly, parts of Africa. So what's going to happen is that the price of bread in these countries is going to go up, and the crisis there will be much more severe than it is here and in the and in the West generally. I see that Biden thinks he's going to get away with saying this is Putin's price hike, but I mean a large part of it, in my opinion, is due to the sanctions that have been imposed on Russia. And I'm not sure that, in fact, people in these countries which are imposing the sanctions, because I mean they shoot themselves in the foot, will agree with this. I mean, in the presidential elections in France, the candidates who were second and third, if you put their vote together, they were both populist and both anti-NATO. They got nearly 50. Well, in fact, they did get more than 50% of the vote if you count other left wing and other right wing parties that were opposed to the policy of the government. And a recent popular opinion poll, I mean they're worth what they're worth, but showed that there's an equal number of people are against sanctions because of the pain it's imposing on them. And I mean, they want the Ukraine war to be settled, and okay, we don't care. Too bad if you lose your charity. We want this to stop so that we don't have to suffer the pain of rising prices. It's not a socialist attitude, but it's an understandable one. Steve.
Yeah. But by the way, Adam, if you like, I'll take over chairing if you like. I'm not bothered about that. But the point I wanted, well, couple of very brief points. Recently saw an article on the BBC website that was talking, obviously, the couched in the terms of inflation. And it says, we're all going to suffer with these price rises. Well, I'm sorry, but we're not. We're going to suffer. Workers are going to suffer. People who have to rely on benefits are certainly going to suffer. But there's a very small section of society that isn't, that are quite happy with the way things are going. But the other thing was, as you mentioned, this misuse of the word inflation, which has now escaped any sort of economic or scientific economics. Could you just talk a little bit about the way that it's actually a government policy, and how it came about? Because I'm not sure that a lot of people here will know about it, and the way that there was a deliberate decision to increase the money supply over years, and it's expanded to an enormous extent. Behind our back, well, not behind our backs, because we know about it, but it's never given any prominence. And it's a deliberate government policy. We just talk about that for a minute, please.
Okay, I mean, Keynes famously wrote once that workers will resist a decrease in their money wages rather than much more than they would an increase in prices, which is an indirect decrease in their standard of living. So that's one factor why governments would like to have not roaring inflation, not stable prices, not falling prices, but gradually rising prices. And of course, there are other economic reasons why we do this. If you have falling prices, people are going to, or at least when they're making big purchases, are going to hold off until expecting the price to come down. So, you know, it's official government policy that they should have slowly rising prices. They deliberately set out to keep the price level, you know, rising. I mean, it was 2.5%. But it's now 2%, and as I said, this is agreed by the meetings of all the central bankers of the G7 countries, which so that they're all pursuing this policy, and of course, what it is, it is a deliberate depreciation of the currency, and it's deliberately putting up prices. That's why prices are going up all the time. I mean, 2% a year compound is quite a lot. I mean, I used to have the figures at my fingertips, but I mean, in within 20 years, you probably, you know, doubled the consumer price index. So I think that's you know one of the reasons why they're doing it. But it is actually it's the official government policy. I mean, the government gave the Bank of England independence when Gordon Brown became the Chancellor of the Exchequer in 1997. One of the first things he did. But I mean, the government doesn't interfere with the, the day-to-day, monetary policy. But it says to the Bank of England, you must keep the price level rising around 2%. If it rises, more than this, you have to give us an explanation. So I mean, that's why I was arguing that at least 2% of current inflation of 7.5% will be the deliberate action of the government. But of course, the government can't bring the consumer price index down. Because I mean, in fact, the governor of the Bank of England has actually said, "Look, I can't do anything about these prices of energy going up. It just cannot be done by means of monetary policy." So, their argument is that this is as I say, I think there's something in this argument. These other prices above 2% are currently being caused by supply chain problems. Now, whether they'll be finally overcome, or how long they last is an open question. I think they're going to last quite a time, which will of course prove a problem for the government, because the wages will have to go up, and so will minimum benefits, so that you know, the cost of living might well not go down back towards in cost increasing at 2% a year. Does that satisfy you?
I'm satiated with it. Thank you. Yeah. No. Just a very quick observation. What you mentioned in your talk about productivity increasing, and I mean it's increased absolutely massively over the last however many years, massive increases in productivity, and it now looks as though we are far better off than we were before, and in fact in material terms we are, but because of this increase in productivity, we've created that much more value as a society that the share that we've got, the social share that workers have got, has probably fallen. So we've not moved relative to the owning class. Anyway, okay, so I said I'd chair it. So Howard Moss, please.
Adam, when I was first in the party, the explanation I was given for rising prices was that it was caused by inflation of the currency, full stop, therefore, it was the policy of the government to do that, and that necessarily caused every transaction to be sort of slightly more expensive, thereby causing the rise in prices. But now it seems clear now that that isn't the only factor, as you were explaining earlier. But I wonder how we can ascertain, if it's possible to ascertain, the extent to which a rise in prices of the kind we're seeing at the moment, the extent to which it's caused by inflation, currency inflation, i.e. determined by the government, and the extent to which it's caused by various other of the factors that you mentioned.
I mean, some of us here can remember double-digit inflation in the 1970s. I think...
20%
something,
yeah, at times, yeah.
But I don't think you can say that it was the deliberate policy of the government, but it was a consequence of what the government did. The, you know, Keynes preached that the money supply or the currency supply didn't matter. You just did it. It was something, it was a consequence of other policies. And as a result, the governments did in fact go on. You know, printing, you know, more and more money, and that caused inflation. So I think it would be fair to say that most of the inflation in that period was due to what the government did. It wasn't a deliberate government policy, as I say. It was a mistaken policy that they were pursuing, which led to that result. Well, nowadays, I think it's the other way around. There is a sort of measure of the amount of currency that's put into circulation. I mean, it's a pity that, you know, Richard isn't here. He can answer your question more. The money supply, in inverted commas, you've got MO, M1, M2, M3, M4, M5, and MO, so-called little mo, is in fact notes and coins. Thus, the reserves that the commercial banks have to hold with the with the Bank of England. And you can see from that figure, what's happening. And during the period that we're talking about, it was going up, but now it's more or less stable. So I don't think you can say that, you know, that's another reason for saying that most of the, you know, rise in the consumer pricing at the moment isn't due to inflating the currency. Now, to answer your other question, I can't see how you could really distinguish what causes what. in the in when there's a rise in the consumer price index, because even with the proper inflation, not all prices automatically go up straight away, by the same amount. So some are going up faster than others, which is happening anyway, because of shortages. Before I hand the floor back hold the chair back to Steve. Productivity doesn't increase, overall productivity doesn't increase very fast. It's only about 2% a year. If you just deal with the savings at the last stage of production, it does appear to go quite a bit. But it should be measured from how much it takes to produce a good or something from start to finish. And in fact, I think productivity doesn't go up much. As I say, it's about 2% a year. So obviously we have produced much more surplus value, than in the past. And this is always working against us. But I think we should be wary of saying that the productivity goes up in leaps and bounds. Anyway, back to you as the chairs.
Okay, thanks. But the compound of 2%, as you said, is pretty impressive, isn't it? If it is 2% per year, that's some impressive advances. Anyway, we'll labour the point. Could we take Comrade Moggy, please? Good evening, Moggy.
Hello. Alan pointed out that the cost of buying groceries has gone up all over the world, even New Zealand. Which is not surprising, I suppose. But then you've got to consider the fact New Zealand is a food-producing country. We produce a lot of fruit, vegetables, dairy products, and yet the cost has been soaring. Now, I can give you some real figures because I actually keep a track of how much I spend in the supermarket every month. Just this year alone, February... For the month of February, I spent $596. March, I spent $686. April, I spent $774. In May, wait for it, $1,329. Now, compared with May of last year, that was $630. So it's going up. And pensions, of course, are not going up accordingly. So it is getting to be more and more of a struggle. But why should food be going up when we produce so much food? We've had all sorts of excuses from the government as to why food is getting more expensive. For example, over the summer, we normally import a lot of seasonal workers from the Pacific Islands to come in for a few months to pick all the fruit. Well, because of COVID, we couldn't bring them in. And so fruit was falling on the ground and rotting. So that put the price of fruit up. And then some areas have had floods and some areas have had droughts. But we're getting these excuses all the time as to why food is getting more and more expensive. It's getting to the stage now where people are really having to struggle and look for ways of actually cutting down on food. And most people just buy the basics. I don't know anyone who does any sort of luxury buying. It's all just buying what you basically need to feed your family. So, it's happening even in New Zealand. There you are.
Okay, thanks for your contribution, Moggy. There was something on the radio today about people that are phoning in to work saying, I can't afford to get to work because it's the cost of petrol's so high or the cost of... everything shot up, so they just can't afford to go to work, which is getting a bit... Okay. We'll take John Cumming then, please. Comrade Cumming, good evening.
Yes, I was just wondering if it would be correct to say that it was really during the 1970s, I think maybe the early 1970s, that the two concepts got conflated, i.e. that of prices rising for other reasons due to costs of production and various other factors, and the issue of excess currency by governments over and above what was necessary. And so the two concepts just became generally called inflation, which there was a lot of about in the 70s. But I don't remember before that people complaining about inflation. They tended to complain about the cost of living. I can always remember my parents and others when I was younger going on about the cost of living and wondering what this peculiar notion really was. But it wasn't until later on that generally people just started referring to price increases as inflation. Would I be correct in thinking that was when it kind of dates to?
Do you want to try and answer that, Adam?
Yeah, but unfortunately my screen went blank. I didn't hear the first part of what John said. But I mean, inflation was at least until the times of Keynes, and even by Keynes himself, we're talking now in the 1920s, 1930s, did mean, you know, what the term suggests. It was an inflation of the money supply, but now it means it's come to mean just any increase in prices. I mean, as far as ordinary people are concerned, it doesn't really matter why the prices increase. But from the point of view of analysing, why they have, I think it's confusing just to talk about any increase in prices as inflation. But I mean, that's what all the papers say, all the politicians say. In fact, we're amongst the few people that still insist on using the word inflation in its original sense. But I would think it must be a post, you know, probably a post-war thing, since post last World War thing.
Well, we're not. Okay, we've got a contribution from Comrade Johnston. Go ahead, Comrade.
Really, the two points I want to make is that, especially in America, with the price of gas, a lot of the left are blaming the corporations, oil corporations, for price gouging. That their profits are still sky high, that they're not reducing their own profits, but increasing prices. I think every oil company has reported bumper profits for this year. The other thing is that with the cost of living, it's not always the price that goes up, it's the size of the product goes down. We have resizing. I think there's a word now called sachets, where everything is being made for one person, or a family are having to buy one person products. Again, we are prices have always gone up. What's happened is that the portions have all gone down. The street food, you're not getting as much, and the more expensive the ingredients are, less involved in it. And remember, where I say street food is probably more important than the supermarkets, and they're suffering by having to reduce what they sell. They can't raise the prices, but they can cut the portions, which they are doing. But basically, that's the only two things I wanted to say was the price gouging, whether that's a real thing that's taking place or whether the corporations are suffering as much as they say they are. And also remember that the price of cost of living doesn't need to go up, it's just that what you get goes down.
Aye, for comment on. They do it. I noticed they do it all the time with biscuits. They seem to make the packet a lot bigger as they reduce the contents by about 2 or 3, 4%. Just before I go over to Comrade Edwards, just draw your attention to the contribution from Ben Foster about the food bank that ran out of food. There was an article on the back page of the Standard recently about the situation with food banks. It wasn't quite as drastic, but okay. Comrade Edwards, please.
Hi, hello there, Steve. Hello, comrades. Yeah, I mean, it makes you wonder to what extent we maybe ought to be rephrasing the term cost of living to cost of existence crisis or cost of existing crisis, to be more precise. There's no doubt about it. We certainly live in very strange times, which, you know, historically, as workers, we have our ups and downs. We might be better off one decade or another, and so on and so forth. But there's one thing I think in this so-called perfect storm that I'm seeing, and maybe it's not such a bad thing insofar as I know that anyone that I meet on a daily basis, whether it's a walk in the park or over a beer, a complete stranger sitting in the bus, speaking with a nurse, then my GP's the other day, and even strangely enough, Moggy, I take you to New Zealand, where a chap that I follow on YouTube called AB Camping, who does some pretty good stuff, and he declares how he's not politically minded. But everyone, without exception, I mean, previously over the years, you'll get some people that'll say, oh, it's maybe not that bad, or this, or that. I have yet to meet anyone that's not been touched by this latest shambles that we're absolutely all having to live through, you know. Whether you're a reasonably well-paid worker or not, everyone is feeling the pinch. And to some extent, you know, we can take advantage of that because people are less resistant to opening their minds up to seeking and trying to find an alternative to this shambles, as almost every person, whether it's, you know, the cost of living, gas, heating, eating, as the term goes, fueling your car, you name it, you know, everyone is struggling so hard just now. Everyone seems to recognise that there's something fundamentally wrong with the system that we all have to endure. Again, there's all these elements, whether it's be Brexit or the war in Ukraine or supply and demand, or no matter where you are in the world, just trying to get things done and delivered, you know, trying to access anything in particular. It's just sort of trying to get through to somebody on the telephone line and waiting, whatever it happens to be. Everything just seems to be such a fucking mess just now, you know. But everyone seems to be recognising that. So that's the sort of thing, I suppose, as a party, we ought to be taking advantage of by, you know, pointing people in the right direction and sowing these seeds of, you know, an alternative form of society. Because I think more people are more inclined start thinking about that rather than rejecting the notion. And, you know, we're not all going to create a surge of party members overnight, but I'm certainly finding that more and more people that you speak to are warm to the idea of, instead of just moaning and blaming all the time, they're actually starting to think about alternatives. And as I say, from a party point of view, that's not such a bad thing. Other things I wanted to say, but I've probably rambled on enough for now, so someone else has done. Cheers, thanks for listening.
Okay, thanks, Paul. Adam, I'll take Pat.
Hiya.
Hi, Lorna.
I'm really sorry, I don't know how to go in the speaking queue, my phone's messed up, so when I can speak, please tell me.
I'll take Comrade Deutsch first then, Lorna. And then I'll ask Adam if he wants to come back in. Comrade Deutsch, please. Comrade, we can't hear you. Can you get closer to your computer, comrade?
Hello, can you hear me now?
That's better, thank you, yeah.
Okay, well, it must have been in the 70s, but I think in the Financial Times they used to regularly have a section with figures in about what the amount of cash in circulation, and for a spell I used to cut these out and save them, but at some stage they stopped printing it. But I just looked in a folder where I've got stuff that I had collected at that time, and I've come across a government guide to the government program, Attack on Inflation, a Policy for Survival. And it has a statement from Harold Wilson inside. On the back page, it says, one man's pay rise is not only another man's price rise, it might also cost him his own job or his neighbour's job. But it's quite interesting as being of the time, and the government putting the blame onto the wages, but saying how they're going to ensure that the year-on-year increase in prices will not be more than 10p in the pound. But anyway, that's fine.
Thank you, comrade. And just to remind the younger element today, that was a Labour government that was talking about how it was workers' fault, and they continually do it despite what they say when they're in opposition. Okay, Adam, did you want to come back in, or can I bring Lorna Stevens in?
Well, I would say something at some point about what Paul said, but if Lorna wants to speak first, I don't mind.
That's okay. Okay, Lorna, please.
Hiya. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
It's just a really small conversation about what I've done today. So I work for the Citizens Advice and also for the NHS in a crossover job. So I spent my day sitting in a car with somebody who they can't get into their house. Their gas has been cut off. She's 73 years old. She can't get any proper health care. Her son, who's disabled, is getting £231 a month, universal credit. I was in his flat today. There's no way that can be heated. He's paying £10 a day on electricity. They've gone through years and years of violence and abuse, and no one's helping them. The system absolutely lets people down. I'm working with people who are dying really early. They've got so many health conditions, and they go to the doctor. Eventually, they get an appointment with the doctor, and the doctor says, "Well, why don't you look after your lifestyle more?" But people can't do that. They've got no way of doing that. They've got no money to be able to do it, and it's getting worse and worse. That's my little input. Sorry.
Well, no, thanks. I'll bring Adam back in a minute to talk about what Comrade Edwards was saying.
No, just comment for a moment on what you know, Lorna was just. I mean, that is the hard end of the cost of living crisis, and I don't know what people can do for people like that. The only thing is, you can be as presumably you are, Lorna, some sort of expert in the benefit system. But I mean, even that's caused all sorts of problems and difficulties in getting through to people. But that is one of the consequences of this cost of living rise on people at the lower income end. But what I was going to say about what Paul said, in fact, also what Pat said, is, I mean, I saw a video advertising this TUC march and rally tomorrow. Although it didn't say so, it was implying that what we need is a change of government, and for the Labour, for a Labour government to come in. But as we know from what happened in the 1960s and 1970s, when there was a Labour government, they came in making all sorts of promises to increase things, and they got into difficulties managing capitalism, the devaluations, wage freezes. They tried to freeze prices as well, but they made exceptions. All this was done by Labour governments, and in the end, the people got fed up and voted in the Tories. The solution to it was, to let unemployment increase, and that itself would keep wages down. I mean, my own view is that if this cost of living crisis isn't solved by the time of the next general election, the Tories will get kicked out, and we will have a Labour government. But I mean, this Labour the next Labour government, or that Labour government, won't be able to solve the problem anymore, and they'll have to take the side of the employers in any strikes and things. In fact, even now, a couple of front bench Labour Party spokesmen have been told off by Starmer for supporting the planned railway strikes. But I think that's what a lot of people will tend to see as the alternative, or maybe they'll just think that the Labour Party won't be as bad as the Tories. But I mean, even that's not certain, because I mean, governments aren't in control of things. They have to navigate by sight as to what hits them.
I don't think we've got anybody in the queue at the minute, so I'll just take chair's discretion. And just to bring in the fact that you're absolutely right. Well, the underlying message for this thing tomorrow is kick the Tories out. And the incredible thing that the left, let's call them that, is claiming that they'll be any different when you see the Tories stealing Labour's thunder by renationalising railways when they don't work, by having a windfall tax on the on these price gouges in the oil industry. So what is the difference? We know for a fact there's absolutely no difference. There's really no difference in life under a Tory government or life under a Labour government. They might be a bit. They might try to appear a bit nicer, but the end result ends up as the same. There's another, and there's an example today of the way that the pressures on national governments work, because the American rate of interest was raised yesterday. I understand that other economies in the Far East have done the same. Japan, obviously Britain has as well. Japan didn't. And what's happened is that the financial capitalists appear to be attacking the yen, and it's dropped in value.
Just getting back to it again, like I said to you, just to get a little bit real in the UK, where I work, people can't get to grips with that. They're just fucking struggling to survive. I mean, they're not understanding politics at all in any sense, other than they need to get food and they need to heat the houses and they need to act. Well, they can't even heat the houses. People aren't even living in houses. People are living in cars. My question is, and that is the reality in it. Sometimes I worry about the party because we're brilliant at talking about intellectual ideas, but this is what's happening to people every day in the streets and now at the moment. I spent the day sitting in somebody's car. I just wonder how we touch people in this situation.
Okay. Well, my view is that when people are desperate because they've no money, they've no heating and electricity, that there's nothing we can do for them. There's absolutely nothing that we can do for them. I'm sorry, but that is the case. And I don't think that we're in this, that they were in a situation where they'd be receptive to socialist ideas. Of course not.
And that's
They want to get the heating back on. They want to get, and of course they do. Of course.
And that's really sad, Steve, and that's what I'm seeing every day. I can't begin to, I mean, I can maybe go to work and talk to people who are sort of doing similar jobs to me about our politics, but there's no way I can begin to talk. I mean, actually, I don't know. What does anybody else think who's in this discussion?
Well, we'll throw that open to Comrade Cumming. If you got something to say about that, John?
I would only reiterate what you said yourself, that there's very little, if anything, that we can do except keep banging on about how awful this society is. The point I was going to make was concerning a video that was sent to me, an email that was sent to me via the TUC the other day, and there was an interesting video. It was about food banks, and it was politicians talking about why people use them. And the TUC were quite charitable about the government and the capitalist class because they were saying they don't get it. And I thought the title of it shouldn't be they don't get it. The title of it should be they refuse to get it or they will not get it, because the explanations they gave were such that, you know, it was just very disingenuous stuff. You had Theresa May saying that, well, there's a multitude of reasons why people might use a food bank. Other people, I think it was that Dominic Raab, that awful man Raab, he said something to the effect that, well, it's not people are not wallowing in poverty. What's happening is that they have episodic cash flow problems, something to that effect. And even some of the other people sitting in Parliament, you know, had to, you know, swoon at that notion. Some of the people sitting behind them who weren't perhaps the most thoughtful people in the world, but at least they recognised that for nonsense that it was. Boris Johnson was also featured on it. In fact, he was probably the star, you might say, in inverted commas, of the little film. And he was asked, do you know what the price of a loaf of bread is? And of course he didn't, but he makes things worse by saying, but I know the price of a bottle of champagne. You know that stupid way he talks. So it's, you know, it's not a question of, you know, we know that they can't do anything within the capitalist system to make it better for us. That's not what they're there for and what the system's there for. But they do make matters worse in the sense that they rub salt into the wounds and they refuse to understand what we're talking about, because they know very well that people are not going to go to a food bank. I don't know where food banks are, but I'm sure
that...
I'm
sure that if I was in a more desperate position than I already am, if I was even more unfortunate, then I would bloody well find out where the food banks are, because I would have to. Otherwise, I would have to go into supermarkets and go in for quite a lot of grazing, as they call it, people just eating food before they reach the checkout. You know, you would have to, you know, you're going to have to eat. So, but that's the sort of thing that government ministers just refuse, and all the apologists for capitalism refuse to acknowledge that poverty is the reason behind these things, and that the reason why they're rich is because we are poor. These things, they like to say, oh, no, it's all much more complicated than that. And guess what? We're the clever, clever people that are going to sort this out. Well, no, they're not.
Okay. Okay, thanks, John. Perhaps you could share that share the link to that film that you were talking about with us. If you put it onto the speaking queue, we could all see it at our leisure afterwards.
Okay.
So if I take Joel next, Lorna, can you just mute yourself while
sorry.
Joel's speaking, please.
Stay. You let Lorna speak before me. I'm easy. I'm fine.
Well, Lorna, have you anything else to say?
Going to respond to the food bank situation because I was going to say. Okay. So, fortunately, in my job, I can click a little button and get people a food bank referral. However, I've been told over and over again that I shouldn't really do that because people need to learn to budget, which we all know is hilarious when you're on Universal Credit. So I was just going to have a discussion about that. Right, I'm going to mute myself now and stop talking.
Okay, thanks, Lorna. You can come back in later if you like. Right, comrade.
Hello?
Yeah. Go ahead, please, Joel.
A lot of what I was going to say has been said, so I don't want to repeat things, so sorry about that. Okay.
All right, okay. Adam, do you want to come back in, or can I go over to Paddy? I'll go over to Paddy. Go, Paddy.
Looking at, what Lorna was saying, it's true, isn't it? There's, there are people in society who are so far down the proverbial hierarchy of needs that it's very likely that they're just not going to, they have time or the inclination to, get involved in political discussion or ideas or anything like that. And that's just the hard truth. So if you're working with people like that, it must be, it's going to be pretty soul destroying, I think. It's except that I suppose it kind of reinforces your own sense that, shit, we have to do something about this. We really have to do it. I mean, we've got a TUC rally tomorrow and, apparently Adam says that, they can't get the London members to go out to it. I'm sorry, but why the fuck not? What else are they doing? But the thing I was going to say, which is a bit more upbeat, is we have to bear in mind also that we think we've got this huge mountain to climb, and we kind of do, but it's not as big as we think it is, because the likely truth is that we don't have to reach everyone. What we first have to do is reach out to people who think like we do, and we've had this discussion before about, we need to be talking to groups that are like-minded, and they do exist. But something I accidentally came across the other day, which I found encouraging anyway, is that there's new research being done in the last couple of years by social scientists who've done a number of studies showing that, or suggesting that, 25% of the population is the tipping point for major change. So they tried these studies, they tried it at 10%, got nothing, 15%, got nothing, 20%, still nothing, 25%, suddenly it all happened. there's a, in fact, I'll, I'm just going to put the link in because I've just discovered the article online. It was just a throwaway comment in something that I read the other day, but I've just found it now. And it just kind of like maybe underlines the fact that although our task is huge, it's not as huge as we think. First, we need to reach the people that think like us. Then they will talk to the people that think like them, and so on and so forth. So for every one person that we reach, they are potentially going to reach, another four or five, and those people are going to reach another four or five. So I think it's easy for us to sometimes kind of lose heart because we're kind of overawed by the sheer scale of what it is we're facing. But actually, we don't have to do all the work. We do have to do some work. We should be doing more, but we don't have to do everything.
Okay, thanks, Paddy. Comrade Foster next, and then I'll ask Cannon if he wants to make any contribution. Mike Foster, please.
Thanks. Yeah, hello everyone. Yeah, interesting discussion so far. I work in homeless services, and I haven't. It hasn't been the right situation to talk with any of the rough sleepers or people in sort of various types of temporary accommodation about politics. You know, as others have said, you know, they've got other things which are more pressing. On them, and I'll probably stick too close to professional boundaries and sort of avoid the subject anyway. It might be seen as a breach of guidelines to sort of get into things too much. I'm not saying that's a reason not to. I'm just saying it's not something we're supposed to do. And even with staff as well, in the places I've worked, there hasn't really been a very much of a sort of political culture. You know, you hear people moaning about the government, and a few people are quite sort of openly Labour supporters, presumably more of the sort of old Labour tendency than Starmerism. But yeah, the union activity is quite prominent in the councils I've worked for as well. But yeah, it hasn't really been all that political, and it hasn't. I'm not saying it'd be sort of necessarily taboo to broach the subject, although I work for a council now, so I haven't worked there for very long, so I'd probably better not start talking about abolishing the state. That might not go down too well. But I suppose my point is that the places I've worked, among the staff teams, there hasn't really been the culture that would sort of encourage talking about our kind of politics. And with clients, again, I've found personally that it hasn't really been the right situation to to talk about similar subjects. And another thing, Lorna, in case you've forgotten, some of the utilities companies have hardship funds. I don't know if that's something you've already considered for the people you mentioned earlier. I think you said one was in arrears with his electricity bill. But yeah, maybe see if there's any hardship funds they could apply to. Yeah. Anyway, that's me done. Yeah. Thank you. Cheers.
Okay. Thanks, Mike. Lorna, do you want to come back? You're in.
So of course, yeah. Mike, but also it's really interesting because I'm partly my job came about through the Morecambe Bay Poverty Truth Commission, which is about talking. So there's no hierarchy, even though we're given money to do it. The idea is that that the people that we're supporting have as much power as I do as the paid workers. So which is really interesting in terms of the party politics, but we know about all those funds, but also I spend a lot of time with people with them just shouting at the state, really.
Okay, thanks, Lorna. Well, we'll take Adam. I'll give you a chance to come back in if you like, or I'll go to Doogie.
No, the discussion's going all right.
Doogie.
Yeah, one thing you notice about society, people don't really remember how bad things were with Labour. You know, if there's a cost of living problem and they want to get rid of the Tories, they'll think things will improve if they change the government, right? Yeah. So I don't know. It's difficult, right? Not everybody thinks that. You know, some people can see through capitalism, but by and large, people just think you need a change of management, right? Yeah. Instead of you need a different system, right? Yeah. So it's difficult, right? Yeah. But poverty. I've known people who commit suicide rate with mental health problems because they don't give them any money to live on, and they give them drugs that screw them up, really, you know, because some of the drugs, you know, you can't think on them, really, you know. And, yeah, I mean, I don't know. I was homeless in Manchester years ago when I was mentally ill. So I've been in that position. But I don't think things were as bad then as they are now for a lot of people, especially with energy prices shooting through the roof, right, you know. And there's people in jobs that are having to use food banks, you know. I mean, it's criminal. And I don't know what we do about it. I mean, a lot of people, I mean, the TUC probably think they just need a Labour government, really, yeah. But, I mean, they should know better, really, you know, because the history of Labour governments is anti-working class because they run capitalism. But anyway, I've said my share, yeah.
Right, thanks to you, Comrade Cumming.
Just returning to this, or continuing with this question of the food banks, I find the food banks, the way they've become normalised over the years, is just as bad, if not worse than, well, can't be worse, but it's just as bad as the fact that they exist at all. In my office, where I don't actually need to go now, I can work remotely, but there used to be at the bottom of the stairs a box where people could chuck in any packets of food and things like that. And then there was a lot of local councillors and members of the Scottish Parliament and members of the real Parliament who would use it as a photo opportunity. They would stand with their legs akimbo and their hands up in the air, with a big silly grin on their face, we're opening this food bank, you know. And it's become so normalised, and it's just, I just find it so disgusting that it's just become part of the thing. Oh yes, we'll give something to charity and that makes it all right, but it's only the deserving cases that can get it. As Lorna mentioned, people are discouraged from actually going to these food banks, and they're insulted with the idea that, well, it's just because you can't budget. How can you budget if you don't have enough? The whole idea is quite absurd. But anyway, it's just the more I talk about it, the more I just become more and more angry. So that's all I have to say.
It's so fucking disgusting. It disgusts me every day. Honestly, the fact that people aren't even being able to afford to put in the food into food banks anymore because they're not well in, you know, they don't have enough money, let alone saying to somebody on fucking £32 a week that they're, £326 a month that they should be able to budget for their food. It's ridiculous. It makes me so angry.
Yeah. Some of these tours, I mean, I'm looking forward to watching this video that John Cummings put up. But so the Conservative Party managers must cringe when they see that dickhead saying, surely people can make a meal for 30p. And yeah. Okay. Well, I've not got anybody in the queue at the moment, so and it's getting to Alan Johnston. Yeah, I was going to ask. We seem to be getting a bit British centric at the moment, so if you can say that it's not about Britain, Alan, be more than welcome. Go ahead, sir.
Sorry to disappoint you, but it was basically what Adam said earlier on was that the strategy defeat the cost of living isn't to replace the Labour government, but it's for the unions to stop agonising and to start organising. I read today that the American AFL CIO have a plan, what they call a plan, to recruit 1 million new members. And it's in the small print that you see that it's over 10 years. And the rise of the working population dwarfs any recruitment to unions. But this is what we should be starting to say and trying to relate. Obviously, it's only for those in work, and Lorna's pointed out that a lot of the problems are those not in work. But for those in work, we have to start saying it's a union that you have to go through to protect yourself. It's a defensive organisation, and you have to defend yourself against the onslaught of capital. And it takes a big union to turn around and start supporting the unemployed, supporting the benefit claimants. But one thing that we have to be careful for is the scapegoating. We already see the scapegoating taking place with migrant workers, the refugee, the asylum. Why are they getting more money than we are getting? Why are they getting hotels and we're in the streets? So it is a matter of defending the working class through organising through the unions. And that's what tomorrow's going to be all about. Our policy should be pointing out that the unions should disaffiliate itself from the Labour Party and start grassroots organising, which you see happening all the time now in America with Starbucks, with Amazon workers. We see it here with the Independent Workers Union doing the cleaners and the gig employees. So our first priority is for the working class to defend itself. And we have to say that you're capable of defending yourself and that you should start defending yourself. And get angry when people turn around and say, acquiesce to Labour Party, Starmer, etc. Like Adam has already said, that they're already blaming the railwaymen for causing misery to other workers, etc. And we'll see a lot of that happening. And that's basically what I just wanted to say, was stop agonising and start organising.
Okay, Adam. Okay, Alan, thank you very much. Adam, do you want to... I think it's... we're getting towards the end, I think. Do you want to come in and do some summing up? Yeah? Go ahead then, please.
Yeah, I was going to say something. I mean, I'm afraid it's a sad fact that people who are on, you know, benefits, they can't do much about their situation. They're at complete mercy of the of what the state decides to hand out. I know that I don't know whether you were involved in this, Steve, but the one time the Bolton branch of the SPGB was the same as Bolton Claimants Union. I mean, that was people who were unemployed, you know, rather than people who were completely destitute. I mean, as Alan has just said, the only people who can do anything immediately about it, even if it is only defensive, are, you know, organised workers. I mean, that is the only, you know, response short of socialism that that we can give to the cost of living crisis to you know, to push up wages as well. You know, but I mean, as I say, it's the situation of people on state benefits, people, you know, getting even some people who are working, who are on these, you know, working tax credit, child tax credits, and so on. I mean, they work more, and their benefits go down. I mean, as I say, people can individually help people sort out the all the bureaucratic things to get all the benefits that they're entitled to under the various acts and so on. But I mean, I can't think we can do much else, you know, besides that. As I say, tomorrow we'll see what we'll see what happens. What sort of response we get. The half a dozen of us who were there handing out leaflets and holding up placards. Incidentally, Steve, I will get some A3 placards done so that we can, you know, pinch a few SWP ones and stick them on them. And so we're going to actually make, placards. Yeah.
Right. Okay. Town hall rallies that I've attended, or rather, I've been outside leafleting. I've spoken to union organisers, like the I think he's the chair in Manchester TUC, talking to a guy from the teachers union in Blackpool and the communication workers union, and I suggested to these people, have you ever thought of putting out a general unionisation campaign? And I got the people like me, retired ex-trade unionists, could go along to places such as Amazon or these small industrial estates. Really difficult to unionise these small places, and of course the full-time officials aren't going to do it. And you know, where you've not got big concerns, unionisation is really awkward. So I was suggesting to these guys, well, why don't you talk to your retired members and put out and have a joint unionisation campaign? I got absolutely blanked. Absolutely blank. And in fact, what we're seeing in Lancashire, Manchester, Bury, and Blackpool, where we've been, Joel, myself, or Lancaster branch have been, we're seeing that even the TUC organisers can't get people to demonstrations. I'm wondering how many people are going to be actually on the demo tomorrow. Because in Manchester, the May Day demonstration was attended by about 150 people. It's absolutely pathetic. And the Bury Town Hall rally that we attended was attended by 40 people. The Blackpool one on Wednesday was attended by about 80, we were told. So the trade unions are finding it hard to get people out. Okay. Hopefully there'll be a few more out tomorrow, and we'll have some impact. At least we've got a way of measuring our impact these days, haven't we, Adam? With these leaflets.
Yeah. It's incidentally, Steve, the Unite Union does have a community section where people like you could could join, and then they do other things, besides strictly trade union matters. But of course they've been forced into doing this because there are quite a few breakaway unions organizing the low paid. They're organizing cleaners and immigrants and so on, in a sense rivals to the big bureaucratic unions. So there are other things going on that people can do and should do.
Right. Hello.
Okay. Well, unless anybody's got anything they'd like to announce,
can you not find the speaking cue
before I close the meeting? You've got about 4 seconds to put your name in the queue. If nobody does so, I will.
I couldn't hear you either.
For your attendance. Thank you for contributions.
Yes, well, you're not actually in there. You're not even in the channel.
So, thank you very much. Good night to you.
I think it's nearly over. Thanks, now, Adam. Anyway.
Thanks, Adam.
Bye.
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 Thank you.
Best of luck on the demo.